comfortable and capable of attacking each other online because they are breaking that eye contact, the spiritual, emotional, and physical eye contact from someone. And so I will do everything to counter that and to provide medicine in an age where we are all really struggling. There's a lot of chaos going around. There's a lot of disconnection. And so how do we all use our voices, use our resources, use the amount of power we each have in our own nook in the world to be agents of love?
That was Rima Zaman speaking to us about her new book, I Am Yours, released February 5th by Amberjack Publishing. I Am Yours has since been adopted into the North Clackamas School's curriculum and become a bestseller at Powell's Bookstore. Zaman is an Oregon Literary Arts Writer Color Fellow. For KBOO News, I'm Emily Gresham Beamer. Thanks for tuning in.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Clinton Street Resistance Series every Monday night at the Clinton Street Theater. Monday, March 11th, Clinton Street Resistance will screen The Big Sick. This screening benefits the Bus Project. Again, that's The Big Sick, showing Monday, March 11th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage, under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the screening of the film Hippie Family Values on Saturday, March 9th at 2 p.m. at Darkside Cinema in Corvallis. Filmed over a period of 10 years at a remote communal ranch in New Mexico, Hippie Family Values is an intimate chronicle of a handful of hippie elders, along with their adult children and grandkids. The director will be in attendance. Again, that's the screening of the film Hippie Family Values on Saturday, March 9th at 2 p.m. at Darkside Cinema, 215 Southwest 4th Street in Corvallis, Oregon. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And it is 7:01 here at KBOO Portland on International Women's Day. And next up is The Struggle.
This is Alyssa Pariah, your friendly neighborhood agitator. I am very lucky to have two of the best comrades that I've ever met, Ashlyn Ruga and Anna So from Critical Resistance, the Portland chapter. What's up, y'all?
Hi.
Okay, well, as you know, I just started the show last week, so it's brand new. The Struggle is meant to bring on local organizers who are doing good work in the community to talk about the history, significance, impact, and some of the dimensions of their work as it correlates to racial, economic, gender justice. So thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for inviting us.
Absolutely. Okay. So before we can even talk about Critical Resistance as an organization, we have to start off, I think, with the fundamental framework from which Critical Resistance springs. So I'm talking about the prison industrial complex and the fight against it. So please say a bit about what the prison industrial complex is, assuming that there's someone listening that doesn't know.
Okay, yeah, thank you. Thank you for talking about the prison industrial complex as opposed to just like mass incarceration or prisons, right? So we use this phrase, the prison industrial complex, that was popularized around our inception. And we have a definition. It's a term we use to describe the overlapping interests of government and industry that use imprisonment, policing, and surveillance as solutions to economic, social, and political problems.
Good definition.
Thank you.
Yes.
I had nothing to do with coming up with it.
And I
also think it's important to mention that the prison industrial complex includes things like white supremacy, cis-heteropatriarchy, anti-blackness as parts of the system that keeps the prison industrial complex functioning and perpetuating itself.
Yeah, we understand it as a system that is rooted in those systems of oppression. And so it's going to be another expression of those, of the ones that Anna named. And so, yeah, something that, like, we're going to inevitably, like, we can't get at the root of the prison industrial complex if we're not talking about these systems of oppression.
Mm-hmm. Just so that we have a working definition, so sort of like amen if I'm hitting the nail on the head in terms of how you understand this, but white supremacy, as I understand it, is a way that settler colonization in the U.S. sort of reared its head, but it has implications globally. And it's about people who descend from European, mostly settlers, but, you know, like European people all over the world that have expressed their dominance economically, socially, and politically on the rest of the world. That's how I understand white supremacy as a system. Is that amenable?
Yeah. And also, I would say that there are also ways where white supremacy is perpetuated in other systems, like in state systems as well.
Okay, I hope we can get into that. I just want to be able to have a framework so that even people who are listening that, you know, maybe have heard of white supremacy, certainly have heard of white supremacists. This is Portland, Oregon. But, you know, just to sort of know what we mean when we say it, right? And then cis heteropatriarchy, as I understand it, cis meaning on the same side of, right? It's like a Greek prefix, refers to people who are not transgender or do not experience gender dysphoria. We would call them cis. And to them, I would say congratulations. I hear it's lovely. Hetero, meaning your sexuality, your orientation towards someone of the opposite gender, assuming you're working within a sort of binary frame. And we're not, but we're not going to get into that. And then patriarchy, which is a system that privileges men over women broadly. And when cis heteropatriarchy play together, that means men who do not experience cross-gender feelings or sexual orientation and don't experience gender dysphoria. Does that seem good?
Yeah. Pretty solid distillation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Just because you said it, right? Mm-hmm, and I don't want to assume that everyone who hears us saying white supremacy and cis heteropatriarchy pertaining to the prison industrial complex, that they're just going to be like, yep, sounds good. Let's mm-hmm. go with that. I don't want to go over anybody's head, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you do good work. You're a good organization, and I want you to grow. And that means being able to relate to people that are not where we are yet, right?
Absolutely.
That's true. Sweet. Okay. So we know what the prison industrial complex is now, and now the fight against it that critical resistance takes up is through the lens of being abolitionists, being for abolition. What does that mean to be an abolitionist?
So that means that we would seek to end the use of prisons, policing, and surveillance as ways or as responses to social, economic, and political problems and issues that we face. So that's kind of broadly the definition of that. And abolition, again, would include abolishing things or seeking to end things like white supremacy.
Yeah, and I think we talk about how abolition is both a long-term vision and an everyday strategy. And so we sit in sessions and we think about what would a world without prisons, what would a world without police and policing, what would a world without surveillance look like?
Mm-hmm.
And we like put that on our vision board. But then we also talk about like what are the everyday steps we can take
mm-hmm.
To build a world that essentially like crowds out the prison industrial complex. Like how are we making police obsolete? How are we making imprisonment obsolete?
Okay.
In our everyday actions and in our campaign strategy and our relations to each other.
Okay. So in this obsolescence, right, or this reach for it. I want to talk about just the base term, abolition, right? And when I think about it, right, when I was first introduced to some of the politics around prison abolition and critical resistance specifically, the word abolitionist kept on making me hearken to the fight against slavery. Mm-hmm. And that is important to the project of critical resistance, which sees the rise of the prison as a site for placing black bodies that are sort of like surplus labor, you know, if we're going to, you know, get into some Marxist terms here. But, you know, people that are throwaways, right? So formal chattel slavery is abolished, ended through the activism of people who called themselves abolitionists to overturn slavery. And yet the rise of the prison is where people who use your framework see that sort of continuing on. So I talk about it, and I'll say what we are abolitionists, but when we say that, we are consciously hearkening back to people in the fight against slavery, and we say we're abolitionists still because the job has not been completed. Is that?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Right on.
Totally accurate.
Okay. I've read some of your materials. Yeah. They're very good.
Oh, really?
Yes. Angela Davis, Ruth Wilson Gilmore, all the good
and
stuff.
And Rose Brass, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So hopefully we can get into some reading recommendations that you have for people at the end. So how did Critical Resistance as a national organization begin? Do you have that story?
Yeah.
Yes.
Would you like to go?
Sure. Well, I wasn't there. I was a child. But back in 1998... there was a group of like academics and organizers and folks who have who were incarcerated, for folks who were still imprisoned, that kind of like got together to be like, hey, this is such a huge issue, like noting the connections that you've just made, Alyssa, and being like, how are we going to tackle this? And so they decided to have like a convening, a gathering, a conference in the Bay Area. 1998. So they, you know, they had like no paid staff or anything. They just like loosely, it was like Angela Davis and Ruthie Wilson Gilmore and Dylan Rodriguez, a bunch of like people who have talked about the prison industrial complex for a long time. Mm-hmm. And so they wanted to bring a bunch of people together to like talk about it and build solutions. So they anticipated like 300 or 400 people would show up, but somewhere around like 4,000 people showed up. Yeah, really, really beautiful moment. So they were like, whoa, okay, this has caught the attention of a lot more people than we realized. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of like where the inception of Critical Resistance as an organization became a thing. And yeah, so since then, there have been, like, we have a structure of, like, chapters in different cities, and there's, like, the national organization. Its home base is in Oakland, California. Mm-hmm. So there are staff there, and there are folks that are members both in chapter organizations and in, like, at-large members that are not in cities that have chapters, mm-hmm. and they do a bunch of different, like, work group work. Yeah.
What about Portland?
So CR Portland, a lot of the work that the CR national staff do is in supporting the chapters. So like CR LA has like their Stop Prison Expansion campaign. CR Oakland has Oakland Power Projects and Stop Urban Shield. CR New York chapter has their Close Rikers and No New Jails campaign, which is great. And CR Portland, I think our biggest campaign is the Care Not Cops campaign. So that is a campaign that started as a way to decouple mental health call response from policing. And the way that we want to move abolition forward with that campaign is through stopping increases to the Portland police budget, ending expansion through stopping new additional police positions from being added, and hopefully for a reduction in the Portland Police Bureau budget overall. And then in addition to that campaign, we do our monthly mail night, which is the third Monday of every month. And we write to people in prisons in Oregon and Washington, where we focus on shared political education and solidarity writing. In December, we're going to have like a end of year mailing where we mail to a bunch of people. So, so many things. We actually do. We have a lot of things going on. We just opened the Dismantle Change and Build Center.
What is that?
So this is a, we took over stewardship of the space, which used to be, in other words, feminist center bookstore. And so now we have kind of transformed it into a community organizing space, a coalitional type of space where we have different groups and organizations coming together and doing like co-working space, having events there. So that's kind of pretty exciting.
Excellent. So I know that you just had the 5-year anniversary for the Portland chapter. And we are hearing a bit about what you're doing now. How do you want to share how you got your start here and why? Why did it sort of pick up in Portland?
So I wasn't here when it started, but it started 5 years ago, 2013. And it started out of a group of folks who were involved in Decolonize PDX. And they were doing a lot of anti-racist actions focused on what they had, you know, they called at the time mass incarceration. So they found out about the opportunity to create a chapter in Portland. So they started that. And then shortly after that was started in the summer and fall of 2013, in 2014 February, they started the mail nights, and that has been going on ever since.
Okay. Well, I want to start talking about the strategies that Critical Resistance uses in order to get their campaigns started and sustained, and then, you know, hopefully to victory, because the model is different from other organizations that use campaigns in order to push themselves forward. And particularly I'm thinking about the sort of no way Jose approach that a lot of nonprofits will have, because if you start talking about the police, the military, prisons, crime and so on and so on, like actually taking on and hurting financially these institutions, actually, like, the funders won't fund you. So how is it that Critical Resistance is able to do their work in a sustained way without having to suck up to, you know, the funders, which, you know, so many nonprofits that start out good end up going to the bad side? Is that okay?
Yeah,
we're not throwing shots. We're not saying names.
No,
we could.
No, we couldn't. No.
You're right. Shoot. So I think, good question. We do have to like suck up to funders sometimes, and like on the national level that looks different than on the Portland level, and I don't know exactly what it looks like for each chapter, but like we all pursue grants in different ways and whatnot, and pursue donations, and so a lot of it is about how we talk about it, and how we can make people relate to this type of struggle. And so we try to get a variety of people involved in the work, and we try to make it accessible, make it clear, make it exciting for folks to like dismantle the prison industrial complex.
I think a good portion of our funding does come from grassroots funding, so it's not a lot of large funders, but for Portland chapter we do get some funding from Social Justice Fund Northwest, and values-wise, they're very aligned and supportive of our work.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Okay. Maybe the tide is changing. I hope it is. But I'm, as an aside, I'm very upset about the lack of gusto behind the fight back with this Trump trans memo. Mm-hmm. And I sat on a panel last night where we were discussing this. And I mean, I was on the panel with like people from Basic Rights Oregon, the ACLU, Kate Brown's attorney was sitting right next to me, and you know, other Democratic Party operatives and things like that. And I didn't know how much rage was going to come out when it was my turn to speak. But I said, in every city that there's been a fight back against this, it's all come from activists who have nothing, mm-hmm. that don't have funders, that, you know, don't work for a nonprofit, that don't have a regular revenue source, that are dying, have precarious employment and housing. And what does it look like that these people who have access to millions of dollars through sort of party apparatus, nonprofit apparatus, that they're not putting their money where their mouth is, and the people that are having to take up the struggle have nothing. And yet, you know, we're meant to believe we're all on the same side. It was very frustrating. So the way that critical resistance engages their work is important in that way, I mm-hmm. think. And I think it should be commended. So congratulations.
Yeah. I want to mention, though, too, I think because we are mostly volunteer members that, you know, support the work, I think it's important to mention that, because I think there are also a lot of larger organizations that have that are national, that have a lot of paid employees, and it's not, you know, critical resistance doesn't operate in that okay. same way. So even though, you know, maybe we kind of like as a chapter here, we kind of look at each other in a way that, you know, we're coworkers, we're not paid by the organization.
Okay.
So
that is important to know. Thank you for that.
I think this makes me think about like when you're talking about this rage that you're feeling and talking about like the different folks that you are like in conversation with around a lot of these issues. It brings up for me the kind of like analysis over what is a reform and what is like abolition.
Oh.
And so we have to like intervene in a lot of narratives that simply reinforce and reinscribe the prison industrial complex and other like expressions of white supremacy, cis hetero patriarchy, capitalism, colonialism, into our like social consciousness. So we want to intervene in that constantly, and we want to recognize that like the work that we do has to always limit the size and scope of the prison industrial complex, okay. and not expand it, no matter how fluffy the language can be. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we don't want like, in response, we don't want to say, well, we want like gender responsive prisons, right? Like we want to have, you know, a whole unit. We're going to build a new prison unit for trans prisoners, mm-hmm. right? Like we want to ask the questions about like why there are so many trans prisoners.
Yeah, great question.
Mm-hmm. And why trans people are so heavily policed.
Great.
And then we want to like build responses in that way, as mm-hmm. opposed to like supporting infrastructure that's going to just expand marginalized people's vulnerability to the prison industrial complex.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. That opens up a lot of questions for me. But I want to give you a chance to piggyback on that if you want to.
Yeah. I think one of the things that we do want to underline is that capitalism. Racial capitalism is a big part of the prison industrial complex, and why it still continues. So that is part of our fight as well. And so I don't think the prison industrial complex can be abolished if we do not also abolish capitalism with
wow.
that.
Okay. Well, you said that you brought it up, not me, but we're going to get there. I'm convinced that if I just make this show like weekly a sort of chastising capitalism show, they may actually not let me keep it. so I want to bring in, we have to talk about this. So let's say police first, then jails, then prisons. Okay. We got to do these three. Let's be honest about how most people feel across the board. Most people generally, while they may not love police and support everything they do, think that we need them. That's true. It's true. Mm-hmm. What do you say to them? You can give me the party line or the organization line.
So I guess, like, in this political moment, like, we always have to assess our political landscape and understand, like, what things we can talk about that people are gonna, like, respond to, or have a reaction to. And so, you know, we have the Black Lives Matter movement. Very grateful for them for, like, bringing the murders of Black people by police to the fore during our generation. And so, yeah, I guess it's just kind of like a lot of asking of questions to be like, so why is this happening? And, like, why do you have to call the police? Do the police make you feel safe? There's a lot of, like, an attempt to, like, get to an analysis around, like, what safety is, what accountability for harm is, why people harm, and, like, why we might need the police. Mm. So, yeah. Do you want to?
Yeah.
You seemed like you wanted to jump in. As well,
I mean, I think I have a lot of, like, thoughts and feelings about, you know, the question of policing. And I think one of the reasons I think people feel the need for police is because people from, and in our society, we're told from, you know, early on that you need to call 911, that the police are the only people who can respond. And in that way, you know, you develop and grow as a person believing in that and not developing your own skills, your community skills in organizing to respond to, you know, friends and family members. And, you know your friends and family members best, not a stranger that you call who responds and is armed. Okay. Yeah. So okay. There's that.
Yeah, I remember the sort of, I felt gaslit, like, growing up when I would learn that there were kids and just, like, people in the world that thought about the police as, like, a place or an institution or people that will, like, lead you to safety. I've always been really afraid of police. Like, some of my earliest memories are members of my family getting beat down, dragged on the street, thrown in cop cars, and then languished in jail because they didn't have bail, right? Or, like, being afraid that the police might find you because you have warrants, because you couldn't show up to court for some, you know, it's like, go down the list. Right, we're poor, we're Black and brown, like, the people that I grew up with never thought about the police as anything except somebody that would bring you harm and danger. And then when I got older and learned that people had other perceptions of the police, I was like, oh, I have to figure out how to engage this. And I'm 31 and I'm just now really trying to figure out how to best really understand the fear that gives way to a culture of policing, so that I can talk about it better. And that's why I'm very grateful that y'all are here to help me think about this and listeners think about this.
Well, thank you so much for sharing, like, that experience, because, like, where I come from, that's not the experience, right? Like, we, as a white person from the suburbs, like, we rely on the police. Mm. Like, we call them. And I no longer identify with that.
On the internet,
yeah. There's a lot of barbecue Beckys and corner store Carolines and, like, all of that.
White people calling the police on Black people for ordinary things that they do.
Yes.
Yes. That's the what we're talking about.
Yes. And like when we think about that, when we like jump into a critical analysis of why that happens, again, like we return to these systems of oppression that we've talked about, and we have to talk about like the actual core and essential function that policing serves. And that is to uphold and enforce the existing structures of power through the use of violence, like through the use of physical violent force.
Coercion.
Coercion. And they get to enact this violence against marginalized civilians pretty much with strict impunity.
Yes, absolutely.
So, yeah, we just think about like, okay, if that is their function, is to like police people who step outside of the bounds of what the norm is, what is acceptable. And the norm is white. The norm is cisgender. Mm-hmm. The norm is heterosexual. Mm-hmm. The norm is male and dominant and coercive, right? Like all of those things. The norm is settler colonial. Mm. Then yeah, like mm-hmm. then it makes sense that that's why we see this, and this is
propertied.
Not yes definitely that mm-hmm. So it makes sense that like that is what happens to people that do not fall within the norm, and that the narratives are just coming out now, or like within the past few years, because like we are able to hear stories of people that like haven't always been able to be on the news or get in the newspapers and whatnot.
Okay, so there's police.
Let's cross that off the list.
Cross police off the list. Okay. If this turns out not to be sufficient, I hope people that are listening will let me know, and maybe we'll pick up the discussion another time. Okay, so on to jails. So it's you know, in case anyone doesn't know the difference between jail and prison, prison is where you serve your time after you've been convicted. Jail is where you go while you await conviction. The problem is in the case of New York, where you were talking about critical resistance in New York City, supporting the Close Rikers campaign, which I follow closely and help them with some of their stuff when I was in New York still. What's up, Darren Mack? I know you're not listening, but hey, what's up? Rikers, for example, it's a tragic example, but it's essentially where you go to be warehoused if you can't afford bail, and you're awaiting a trial, and you don't have the money to get out. It's like where you go to languish, and you are essentially like made to do that because you're poor. If you had the money, you'd be good to go, and you'd be awaiting trial outside. That's what most people do, right? Unless the judge makes special arrangements or what have you. But for the most part, you know, while you await trial, you can go free. But you gotta have the money. And if you don't have the money, well then you'll just be in jail sometimes for years. So please talk about the effect of awaiting trial and being in jail, and the economic dimensions of who goes to jail and who stays in jail. Please, please.
Yeah, so I think jail tends to be, I mean, connecting this to policing, the folks, black and brown folks who live in heavily policed communities are the ones going to jail. And when somebody goes to jail, they end up being taken from their communities. That means maybe somebody's family members, other community members aren't able to receive the social and other types of support that a loved one provides them. Their jail isolates people, like keeps people from participating in, you know, in community and from working as well. If you wanted to talk about capitalism and, you know, kind of removing labor from the market, what people would, you know, call excess labor. So that is another function. I have, if you want to add to that.
Yeah.
If she got it, she got it.
I mean, yeah.
Okay. She got it.
Okay.
All right, moving on. Okay. Crossing off jails. Great.
Oh, if it was only so easy.
So then prisons, right? Where generally people understand, right? Again, we need to be honest about where most people are at. people who commit crimes need to be put away. That is widely understood to be true. Critical resistance does not hold that. Nope. Talk about that, please.
Yeah. So what is a crime? Who is a criminal?
Great, so provocative.
I practiced in the mirror earlier. Just kidding. So that is the like common logic. That is the common carceral logic, is that there are people that do bad things and they have to be held accountable in a way that is heavily punitive. They have to be taken away, isolated from their families, from their communities, put in this cage, and then like somehow that is going to make them like better, or that is going to make our society stronger. Mm-hmm. So that's a logic that after I've like thought about it for a while, based on like lots of great conversations with lots of wonderful people, it's pretty absurd, but it's also pretty strategic. So if we're able to like take factions of people, take demographics of people, and designate them as criminal, then we are able to like have an epic amount of control over them. And then we are able to isolate them, and we are able to like exploit them, exclude them. So that's a pretty essential function when we consider the like ideological and political logic that this country was founded upon. So we incarcerate a quarter of the world's prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And we have how much of the world's population?
5% Thank you. Yeah. So is it because we have it's just like the most evil people in the world in the U.S.? I mean, I would argue yes, but not the people that are in prison.
That's a good one. Some of the logic around prisons and how your mind changed around it, please.
Thinking about how criminalization works, when people are imprisoned and they're isolated, and it's a group of people who, you know, a lot of people, it's difficult to communicate and correspond with people in prison. I think it's very easy for, you know, people generally to just assume that the messages that they're getting from media, from TV shows, from schools, from all of these places that tell people that people who are in prisons are bad people, to believe that, because the state makes it so hard to communicate and to share and make connections. Prisons are places where people are dehumanized and traumatized by the state, which also means that if people are in prison and they come out of prison, they go back to communities without, having had that experience and without any type of support to try and, you know, remedy all the harms that the state has caused and done to them.
Oh my goodness. Okay. I think before we go away from prisons, I want to circle back to Anna So, what you just mentioned about the being imprisoned as being a dehumanizing experience, to whatever degree you're comfortable. Can you talk a little bit about that? What about it is dehumanizing?
Well, the fact that the rules of prison, where a lot of people aren't able to hug each other, touch each other, your schedule is regimented by the prison. Sometimes kept them from reading certain news, from knowing what time it was. So many you know, daily injustices being punished for what they call minor infractions, for not conforming to some arbitrary regulation, those types of things.
Okay. Do you have something to add to that, Ashlyn?
I could. yeah. So I guess like an anecdote is like my friend who is incarcerated in Eastern Oregon like called me yesterday and we talked for a while and he had to pay for the phone call, of course. He was giving me his address and he made sure he gave me his like number. And he was like, yeah, just remember, like, they don't refer to me
by my name.
Yeah, just my number. And it's this like several digit number. But when he has to be like called out for something, then they call the number and not his name. And that's the way the prison functions. And I think that that is like very illustrative of the purpose that it is supposed to have, which is incredibly dehumanizing.
Yeah. Warehousing people.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think one like piece of this is always putting it on the individual as opposed to the structural.
Yes.
Always saying that like you, person who is committing a crime, and I'm putting crime in quotation marks, often a survival crime, right? Because people are not getting their needs met, are the bad person, the person that deserves to be punished. And again, like this is our framework for punishment, is we take you away from your family, away from your community. And we tell you that you don't deserve the things that a regular human deserves. You don't deserve to know what time it is, to have your real name, to choose like what you do with your day. Yeah, I think that logic is very damaging and so central to how we maintain the prison industrial complex and our structures of power in society in general.
Thank you for that. Really. And if it seems like I'm overloading you with questions, it really is because I know both of you to be so brilliant and full of information, and I don't want you to keep it to yourselves. More people need to know what you know. And I want to be able to bring that forward to as many people and as wide an audience as possible. So as a sort of comparison, I've been paying attention a lot to Brazil and the elections there, where they may very well be voting in a far-right candidate for president who is openly sympathetic to military dictatorships of old, openly misogynist, homophobic, transphobic, racist against black people. And it's been put forward in multiple sources, people that I read and respect, that refer to the problems as stemming from the fact that Brazil is a slave society, and that the racial and class dimensions of sort of a Portuguese ruling elite and a marginalized indigenous group of people whose land was grabbed, and a large section of enslaved Africans that were brought over in the Middle Passage, sort of because of their refusal or inability to ever solve that, that is why they're experiencing so much turmoil right now. And I hear that, and to a large degree, I agree. But I think, isn't that exactly what's happening here too? Like, I look at the Trump phenomenon, and I see it in this sort of like pantheon of like other actors throughout history and events throughout history that have placed us exactly where we are, and there's like a refusal to engage with that. I think like we started out absolutely as a slave society that was dead set on manifest destiny, aka slaughtering indigenous people and rewarding people for settlements, which is not over, by the way, but here we are. And then when chattel slavery is officially ended, and there's a period at attempt of reconstruction, it gets undermined by white terror, which we see more of today, like, you know, these bombs in the mail to, you know, prominent adversaries to Trump, political adversaries of Trump, And it's not being called white terror. It's very interesting how terror gets assigned. Anyway, and then I think about black codes, Jim Crow, vagrancy laws, a refusal to ever grant universal housing, universal jobs programs, that because we're a slave society that never came to grips with the racial and class ramifications of that, here we are, and we're warehousing a quarter of the world's prisoners, and we're 5% of the population. Like, to me, that is as big of a tragedy as the possibility of people in Brazil electing a far-right candidate. And it's just, it's not acknowledged as such. This, to me, says that the project of the US of A is a failure. And I don't understand why this is not more widely understood. But here we are. That's what's been swirling in my brain, thinking mm-hmm. about this stuff.
Yeah, and it is a global problem, white supremacy and capitalism and exploitation of people. So I think that is part of, and U.S. imperialism is part of what drives the refugee crisis, what drives immigration, and all of those things. And then I think the close alignment of state power with global corporations and capital is also a huge part of the system that also is based in anti-blackness. And I don't, you know, keep up with it as much as I should, but I do keep up with, you know, the way that the way that China is kind of right now exploiting a lot of the countries in Africa for resources. And that is, to me, a very similar thing to what the U.S. does and has done.
And I would, yes, thank you for drawing those connections. And I'd say, like, the settler colonial project that is the United States of America, the empire, is so, like, on one end, yes, a failed project, but also one thing we talk about is that it is working exactly the way it was intended.
Thank you for that.
Right, so it's not broken.
A question of angles.
Right? So it's, we don't talk about how it's broken. We don't accept that narrative because we understand that, like, there is an intense intentionality behind that. So, like, once 1865 hit and we freed the slaves in quotation marks, uh-huh. then all of a sudden these, like, black codes, these slave codes that you're talking about proliferate. Uh-huh. And suddenly, within a period of, I want to say, 10 years, the people who were incarcerated, which was at a very low rate, most of them were white, or pretty much all of them were white, and then the demographic completely flipped to black people being imprisoned. And then we had the chain gangs and, like, all of these ways that black people were not actually able to escape chattel slavery.
Yeah.
It was just called a different name.
Yeah. Okay. So I want to pull, right, to 2018 or to a more contemporary reference point here. So I think about the war on drugs and redlining. And that they are different tactics in a larger move to criminalize black people.
Mm-hmm.
And that if you are able to criminalize them via the war on drugs and redlining communities, which, you know, for people who don't know, that looks like a sort of get tough approach to buying and selling drugs in black communities is what we would understand as being the war on drugs. And then redlining, meaning a covenant that banks make with municipalities that promise not to make loans in given areas where black people are forced to live and work. And that means no investment. And that any society would put forward that it is the fault of those people who are living under those conditions that imposed on them, it takes a special kind of sadism, I think, to say you are at fault for what it is that we are putting on you to bear. Not only that, we refuse to acknowledge that we're putting it on you to bear. It is so wild that I'm like, oh my God, is this country like run low-key by demons? Like, I don't know. Like, that is evil. I read science fiction and fantasy, and I read about like actual like demons, and I'm like, whoa, like they're almost as evil as the U.S. Empire. Okay.
Yeah.
Poverty is the worst form of violence.
I appreciate you saying that, because sometimes I like sit and think about the conditions that we live under, and I'm like, is this actually real?
Yeah.
This is reality. Yeah. This is like the way the world works. And yeah, it's like unfathomable that this is what was prioritized. Mm-hmm. And we did not center people. We centered, and by we I mean not the people in this room, but yeah. So that, yeah, I appreciate that.
Yeah, and I think that kind of bringing it back to kind of how we want to make change, you know, we see that there are so many, like the state and corporations have so much, so many resources and so much income. And yet there are people who don't have homes, people who can't, you know, cannot afford healthcare, cannot afford, you know, things that should be basic, that are basic human needs. And I think, you know, our frame of dismantle, change, and build is part, so I think is so important to how we do the work, because yes, we do want to dismantle these structures, but we also want to change the conditions, which would look like advocating for no increases in budgets for police forces, and reallocating those resources to people and supporting people's needs, especially because the people are the ones that are the workers and creating this wealth for the state and the corporations. So, and then hopefully changing those conditions will help people have the resources they need to build up their own, you know, skills, like all of those things that would help to everybody to be able to respond to other people's needs and to react to situations that happen in their communities. So I think that, you know, bringing that all together is important, and that's, you know, moving forward by doing that work hopefully will help us.
Well, okay, you went into what I was going to ask you next, which is very important. So when someone hears your line, right, you give them the pitch, you know, you're tabling or you're at an event and you're, you know, sort of explaining who Critical Resistance is, what do? What do we believe in? All of that. You've gone through all of that, and now you come to the point where you talk about what you're working on right now. And a piece that's so important is, as you just said, Anna Soul, that it's not just that we want to dismantle these systems and everything else is whatever, you know, the chips will fall wherever. No. When we say we want to dismantle, we say we want to dismantle these systems by changing the conditions. And that it won't just be some side effect, but we have a strategy and a tactic of defunding the police in Portland, Oregon. I'm talking about the Care Not Cops campaign. Please talk about the Care Not Cops campaign and the politics behind it in Portland.
Yeah. Thank you for bringing us there. So, yeah. As Anna talked about earlier, the Care Not Cops campaign started back in February of 2017 after a variety of like community forums where the community around like the Dismantle Change Build Center, formerly, in other words, like folks in Portland who are policed, were asked like what issues were biggest around policing. And so again, like as a prison industrial complex abolitionist organization, we understand we want to like tackle all forms of surveillance and imprisonment and policing. And, you know, as opposed to like LA or New York, there was not a new jail campaign, thankfully, but we love our cops in this city. We love the Portland Police Bureau. And so again, like we have seen.
Can you clarify?
Sure. So many ways to clarify.
Hearing that out of context, hearing critical resistance person saying you love Portland
okay,
police.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for that. So yeah, I was being tongue in cheek. Liberals love, liberals all the way to right wingers love the Portland police, except for right wingers are like kind of mad at the mayor and PPB a little bit sometimes.
Not for the right reasons.
No, definitely not. But yeah, so we had to understand, we wanted to employ this framework of dismantle, change, build. Like we wanted to attack the narrative that the police were something that were positive, right? This city is 78% white, right? And so we have so many barbecue Beckys and whatnot that are going to just call the police on black people for doing whatever, anyone. Yeah. Yeah. So that was a thing, but then also, the police murder black people at heavily disproportionate rates. And so that's never been different. People are getting into rooms to talk about it more these days. Back in maybe like 2015, I think is when the forum started. And it was conversations with like folks who are more impacted by policing, asking like what was going on. And so one big need, there were several needs that were identified. And I was not part of these conversations. This has all been relayed to me. Okay. So one of them was mental health crisis response. Okay. And as folks are like experiencing extreme states and having to, you know, like contend with a reality that feels really different, like who's going to respond to that and in what way? Mm. That was one thing that was identified as a big need.
So can you talk about the argument to move money away from the police budget into a new budget that would seek to serve people for mental health crises?
The campaign is called Care Not Cops because we want resources to go to the community for health services, mental health services, transportation, and all of those types of things. So it was important to us to mobilize when the proposed budgets came out in 2017 and 2018, because we knew that the PPB would always seek increases to their budget.
Always.
So I think it was important for us to try and mobilize people to turn out to city council budget hearings, community budget forums to show that that people in Portland, and particularly people in East Portland who needed transportation or had other needs, those needs were not being met. Our partnership with YEJA, Youth Environmental Justice Alliance, their youth pass was not funded. So we were able to partner with them and try and help to advocate for funding of that as opposed to policing.
Yeah, get the kids on the bus instead of funding the cops. Okay, so finally, how do people get in touch if this sounds good to them?
So we have Facebook and Instagram. I believe it's Critical Resistance Portland on Facebook Critical Resistance PDX on Instagram.
Website, Twitter?
We have a website. You can find us also on criticalresistance.org. You can look up our chapter there. And Twitter is CR_PDX.
Okay. What about regular meetings? Where, when?
So one thing that folks who want to volunteer with us can do is come to our monthly prisoner correspondence nights. So that's third Monday of every month, 5:30 to 8:30 p.m. So that's how you can meet us, get involved. It takes a little more like training and relationship building to become a chapter member. But that's something that we recommend folks to do so you can start getting engaged in the work. And then our Care Not Cops campaign will be opening up in the next couple of months. We might put a Facebook event up, so look for that.
Yeah. And you can email us at crpdx@criticalresistance.org.
Thank you very, very much. Final thoughts for people as we exit?
I guess we just like to talk about abolition in terms that people want to understand. And so asking us questions is great, but understanding that we want to build a society in which everyone has their needs met. Like, that's the main priority, as opposed to a society in which we rely on exploitation and exclusion and violence.
Very good. Final words.
Get in touch with us. We'll try to be at community events in the next couple months. So if you see us, say hello and get strike up a conversation.
Excellent. Okay. Thank you, everyone. Talk to you next week on The Struggle. Alyssa, your friendly neighborhood agitator.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the screening of the film Hippie Family Values on Saturday, March 9th at 2 p.m. at Darkside Cinema in Corvallis. Filmed over a period of 10 years at a remote communal ranch in New Mexico, Hippie Family Values is an intimate chronicle of a handful of hippie elders, along with their adult children and grandkids. The director will be in attendance. Again, that's the screening of the film Hippie Family Values on Saturday, March 9th at 2 p.m. at Darkside Cinema, 215 Southwest 4th Street in Corvallis, Oregon. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
At KBOO, we accept many kinds of vehicle donations. We accept fuzzy vans, broken cars, zippy scooters, seaworthy boats, well-worn farm equipment, family-sized SUVs, old jet skis, and more. If your vehicle has a clean title, we can take it as a donation. If your vehicle isn't working, we can work with that too. Call 877-KBOO-123. That's 877-526-6123. Or go to our website, kboo.fm/vehicle.